This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the city and county split over whether to finance Bruton and Marcus Smith's Major League Soccer dreams. Meanwhile, city council smooths the road for taxi drivers trying to compete with Uber. Former North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory is pursued and yelled at in D.C., and that triggers a North Carolina proposal to protect former elected officials. Women's marches take place all over the country, including Charlotte, and a powerful North Carolina woman, Ruth Samuelson, dies at 57. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. We're joined by WFAE's Tom Bullock. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Roll call columnist Mary C. Curtison, contributor to WCCB News Rising, returns, as does Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Thank you.
And Ann Doss Helms is here from the Charlotte Observer.
Morning.
Morning. You can reach us all through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter. You can use Twitter at Charlotte Talks or the hashtag WFAE Roundup. So yesterday, an hour after the Mecklenburg County Commissioners voted to kick in $43.75 million to fund a new stadium should Major League Soccer come to town, the Charlotte City Council canceled a vote that had been scheduled for today. Why?
Ah, yes. That sound you heard yesterday, the clank of a ball hitting the goalpost. Sorry, I had to use a sports metaphor. They canceled it because they said they need more time.
Yeah.
They need more time to hear from the public. They need more time to talk about, whether or not the stadium is a good idea to consider the proposal. And it came – yesterday was just a whiplash day when it came to the soccer deal because – a lot of us, at least in the WFAE newsroom, thought the real hurdle was going to be the county commissioners because their chunk of money would come from their capital building budget, which is, you know, for things like, oh, you know, you can build schools with them, you can build libraries, you can build parks, whatever it is. But they voted yes, and it was 5-3. So,
and that's taxpayer money.
Absolutely.
Local taxpayer money. The city's money for this was going to come from the tourism, hotel and tourism
Correct.
Tax, which is not necessarily local taxpayer money unless you spend the night in a hotel.
Well, it's also money that can only be used for, you know, tourism things.
Yeah.
So it really did seem like the county had the bigger task. And the county, again, they approved it. It's, you know, $43.7 million to help build this stadium, plus they would cover, you know, basically, what is it, 75 – well, maintenance costs, but that would also front the Smiths $75 million for construction costs that the Smiths would then pay back over 25 years. And, you know, the arguments were interesting because you have Councilman Trevor Fuller saying, well, when you work everything in, economic advancement, economic development in the Elizabeth neighborhood, which I will say outright I don't think is exactly the center of blight in Charlotte – that it would work out to about, you know, he claimed that the county would only actually pay about $3.6 million. That's, you know, we'd have to wait to see if that would happen.
Well, here's what Mayor Pro Tem Vial Lyles had to say yesterday after it was announced that they were going to not take a vote on this issue.
Major League Soccer is something that would be great in our city, but we have to be able to express and understand the project, the deal, and what the community's reaction is, and we didn't have the time to do that.
Why did the county have the time to do that? They've already held a public hearing on this.
Well, and Charlotte City Council could have done it today. I honestly think it's not just about hearing from the public. It seems pretty clear at this point, at least, that the proposal will not pass the City Council.
Mm-hmm.
There were at least five members of the Charlotte City Council that either outright said they would vote against it or seemed to be leaning that way. Actually, a sixth, if I count Ed Driggs. And therefore, the deal was dead. So they put it aside. They said they weren't ready to talk about it right now. And it does, you know, it seems likely that the deal is dead, mm-hmm. At least aside if the Smiths are counting on taxpayer dollars to fund their, you know, to prop up, in essence, the stadium for this new business venture they want to get into. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's dead. The Smiths could still pony up the city side, and the county still voted and still approved this. So if this goes forward, the county is still on the hook for the money that they agreed to spend.
To, yeah. And presumably the Smiths could go ahead with this saying, we're going to do this application, but we're going to come back to the city and we're going to keep making our case for city participation.
Absolutely.
I mean, this feels so much like a deal on a car lot, you know, from the sign fast, this deal won't last, to the extreme hyperbole, you know, this is going to be the crowning achievement of a generation. It's going to fix the troubles that came out of the riots in September. And, you know, so you wonder, is the city the guy that's walking off the lot and maybe eventually going to come back, or have they really walked for good?
Yeah. And
so one of the stories it did say, one of the comments was, I've purchased a car with more consideration than this.
Right.
Well, part of it is the optics that, you know, we are going to give very rich people money to do this, and there's this deadline, and you have to make the decision now. And people felt we may have been, the city may have been burned in the past with these kinds of deals that didn't quite work out as it had been advertised.
As I understand it, the deadline came from Major League Soccer.
Correct.
Is that correct?
That's
Why
correct.
Was it so quick?
That's a very good question. I mean, the Major League Soccer is going to expand by two teams. They're going to make the announcement of which cities get those teams this year.
There are 10 teams in the running,
including
Raleigh.
Well,
or 10 cities in the running.
Nine, actually, now, because the St. Louis City Council yesterday voted against a stadium proposal where they would have used taxpayer money to fund.
Don't they have a stadium that the Rams aren't using anymore?
Wah, wah.
That they're still paying for?
I stand by my wah, wah. So it's and you know, one of the other sites is Raleigh. And what seems interesting to me is, was this – and I don't know the answer to it, but it's a question that I would love to find out the answer to, which is, was this a deliberate move, in essence, either by the Smiths or Major League Soccer to put the most pressure, the most leverage on the county and city to get what they could, or was this deadline just because – you know, or the closeness of this to the deadline, because the deadline is on Tuesday. Well, was this just because of, you know, we didn't get our act together quick enough?
City and county were being asked to put in $43.75 million each. And the Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority estimated that the stadium would produce $41.5 million in new visitor spending each year. If that's true, it would have taken about 2 years, a little over 2 years, to recoup that initial investment.
I'm going to challenge Eric Spanberg, who's obviously always on this show or often on the show, and simply say these estimates are more art than science.
Okay.
We don't really know what the economic impact is until it actually happens, and then a lot of times, depending on the analysis, either the money comes or it doesn't.
Glenn.
I think Mary's on to something when she talked about there just not being an appetite to give a lot of public money to rich people. I see this as more than just a local thing. When you look at what's happening on the national stage with Donald Trump, and there's very much a backlash. There's a populist backlash out there, and I think part of this, the city council's reluctance, is just being reluctant to hand over public money to billionaires.
And it's an election year, and they've gone through a really, really, really tough year last year, the city council, because of the ordinance that led to HB2, correct?
Absolutely.
And particularly, it's not giving enough people a chance to get up and talk about their opinions. Mm-hmm. You know, citizens want to have a voice, and the whole sense that there are a whole bunch of people in a room pulling the strings, and we're going to be on the hook for the money, as you said, Glenn, it's just not there.
But actually, county commissioners can count on this being thrown back in their face during budget discussions, and this is kind of a perennial dance in Charlotte, but you know, everybody who's coming in for money for schools or libraries or human services is going to be saying, well,
up.
You had that $44 million
or
you know.
Soccer.
Yeah, you just whipped out the checkbook and said yes.
I don't recall a year when the school system has not come to the council with a, or the county commission with a budget request, at which time the budget the county commission says, that's too much. Here's what we're going to give you. So now, do you think they have the guts to say, yes, it is, it's just fine, and you can afford it because you were willing to put $43 million toward a stadium?
Oh, I think people will say that. I think school board members will say that. I think there will be people packing the public hearings with signs, you know, saying whatever. But again, that's fairly normal part of the dance. So
And the dance is a little different simply because of this. Soccer is a revenue-generating activity. The stadium would bring in money. How much? Totally debatable. But I could easily see the county commissioners saying, well, you know, this would offset that to make it so it's not necessarily an apples for apples comparison.
Although people would make the counterpoint that good schools also are not an immediate revenue generator, but certainly a long-term economic stimulus.
Absolutely.
I was reading some comments on social media last night, and one person pointed out that every African-American on county commission voted for this, voted to give the money. And
James Mitchell on city council was prepared to vote yes, I
right.
believe.
At a time when our schools especially in the African-American communities, are really hurting. We're trying to do something about homelessness. We're trying to provide affordable housing for poor people. There's just a disconnect there.
Why?
I don't know. I think Charlotte is just obsessed with shiny new things, and I think that to some degree, maybe those elected officials on county commission have not realized the depth of anger, resentment that is out there in the community. We thought that during the demonstrations and riots that perhaps they had finally sat up and taken notice, but this vote belies that.
Well, all over the country, though, and here in Charlotte as well, there's this new level of activism. So perhaps we'll see more pushback and more opposition when these folks are coming up for election.
Well, years ago we had a referendum on whether or not we should build an arena for basketball, and the citizens said no. And then the city council went ahead and said, okay, we're going to do it anyway. Has the environment changed that much? And that turned out to be a pretty good decision.
I think the environment has changed tremendously since then.
All right.
In just about every way you can imagine.
But who's right? I mean, if the citizens had said no, we wouldn't have the Hornets, and we wouldn't have that building either, and there'd be this big hole downtown. Who was right, the city council or the populace at large?
I don't think that's an answerable question.
Okay.
I mean, it's one of those things where you have to, but I will also say this to add to Glenn's point too. You know, the Charlotte City Council has also said that upward mobility and the lack of it in Charlotte, in Mecklenburg, I mean, it's dramatic and it needs addressing, that they actually are trying to focus on.
Well,
that.
Michael Smith was misquoted by – Michael Smith from Charlotte Center City Partners was misquoted in The Observer about his comment about how this would help ease tensions around the city that we uncovered during the Keith Lamont Scott shooting and the aftermath of that. He basically said that this would allow more internships, and I'm going to misquote him again. I don't want to misquote him again. But basically, it would allow more internships and more apprenticeships and help people find ways to get involved in a business that could lift them up, essentially. He's not right about that?
I'm not going to say he's wrong about that, but I think that effect would probably be minimal. I think the people who are concerned about schools, who are concerned about affordable housing, who are concerned about upward mobility, I think they're looking for something other than a very long-term payoff, and that's what we're talking about.
And I think if you do the what-ifs, you could say not just what if we didn't have the Hornets, but what if we didn't have the Hornets because we had invested massively in fighting homelessness or in improving education or neighborhoods or whatever. Mm-hmm. It would be – you don't know, but it would be an interesting speculation.
So how is Charlotte going to feel if in – whenever – I don't know what the timetable for selecting a city is, but if when that happens, the city turns out to be Raleigh? How are we going to feel about that?
Probably no better or worse than realistically we feel now. I mean, I'm a soccer fan. I love soccer. There's a huge soccer community here in Charlotte as well. But I don't think it's going to massively change anything. I mean, at the end of the day, this is a professional sports team in a league that is growing but is still considered a second-tier league.
And we have a team, minor league team, with aspirations to go major league at some point in the future.
Absolutely. We also have a number of international friendlies here that often, you know, if it doesn't sell out Bank of America Stadium, it's near capacity. Mm-hmm. I think it's just like hockey fans. I don't think Charlotte, you know, cried itself to sleep when Raleigh got a hockey team and we didn't.
Okay. City Council also voted on taxi rule changes, which we'll talk about in a second. And Mayor McCrory was hounded in Washington, D.C. On Inauguration Day, I believe, or the March on Washington Day. We're coming right back to talk about that. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the British International School of Charlotte, dedicated to unleashing the potential of every child through its personal approach, international curriculum, and new collaboration with MIT. Reservations for school tours at bischarlotte.org. An urgent vet pet clinic providing veterinary urgent care 365 days a year for Charlotte pet owners. Locations now open in Fort Mill and Belmont. Your pet can't wait to feel better. More info at urgentvet.com. Well, in the early days of telephones, a lot of people were suspicious of those newfangled devices and were kind of entering a period not unlike that again, as digital assistants like Amazon Echoes and Google Home devices are starting to become household fixtures. Millions of them are just waiting to help us, but to help us, they have to listen. How much are these things hearing, and what's happening to what they're hearing? Should you be concerned? We'll talk about that Monday at 9. We'll talk with a human about it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, President Trump's first week from alternative facts to lots of executive orders. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues with On Point from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks here, an annual Friday event, a weekly Friday event with Tom Bullock, a reporter for WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, NBCBLK, NPR, WCCB, and the list goes on. Glenn Birkins just has one job, editor, publisher of Q-City Metro, and Ann Doss Helms with the Charlotte Observer. Charlotte City Council did other things this week. They met and they voted unanimously to smooth out a road that has become increasingly bumpy for taxi drivers in our town trying to compete with alternative services like Uber. They proposed new rules. What did they propose?
Well, they actually passed those rules. Yeah, so it's, not just a proposal. Basically, it's two parts. The first part is it allows taxi companies to go ahead and do more advertising on their cars. So you can see it will look a little bit more like New York City this way. You know, they can have rooftop advertising. They can have those lovely—
Don't they have it now?
They do more, but you can have lovely those infotainment little televisions in the backs of taxi cabs that tell you all sorts of random things. But the key thing is it really comes down to fees. And as of right – or before this was approved, taxi cabs could not recoup costs that the city charges for pickups at, say, Charlotte Douglas Airport. Now they can.
Could Uber?
Yes. So as of right now, it was really just more of a leveling of the playing field. And there's some other details in there too.
So why would Uber be recouping fees at the airport when they're in competition? Why wouldn't they just waive that too? Does that make them more expensive than taxis?
Not necessarily. I guess it matters on where you're going and the overall charges. But the core question that you have there is why isn't Uber paying the same? And that's simple. That's because they are not actually regulated under the passenger vehicle for hire standards, mm-hmm. Because they're not considered passenger vehicles. They're not considered taxis. It's a different service. So this makes it a little bit easier for taxi cab drivers to compete on a level playing field.
So last weekend was a momentous weekend, and it seems like it wasn't last weekend. It seems like it was a month ago, but it wasn't. Friday was Inauguration Day, and Saturday was the women's marches all over the country.
Shame on you! Shame on you!
And Donald Trump wasn't the only politician being protested last weekend. A video made an appearance that showed former North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory being pursued and cornered at a locked door with several others.
You anti-gay bigot!
So how did this happen?
Well, McCrory was spotted by a knot of protesters. He was in Washington, D.C., and, the chants ensued that you just played. And they follow him for about 3 minutes, a little over 3 minutes, actually. Yeah. And what's interesting is, to some, this is just protest. You know, as I said in a story about this, there was the occasional expletive thrown, but no punches, nothing physical. Eventually, a uniformed officer asks the protesters to leave, which they do when they finally, open this door for Pat McCrory to go in. And for a lot of people, it's just that's kind of the expected life of a former politician.
When you look at the video, which, as you said, is about 3 minutes, it's almost as though these people stumbled upon former Governor McCrory and then followed him down this alley. And then when he couldn't get into the door, they didn't know what to do with it. The protesters didn't know exactly what to say. They had him cornered. And it was like, they were just fumbling for things to talk about.
Yeah, if you read the Facebook post in which that was originally posted, that's what they said, was that this was a group of triad area activists who had come for the protests. And they were walking down the street and they said, hey, there's Pat McCrory. So they kind of got together and said, what can we do? And they got out their cell phone and they started shouting at him. And yeah, then they were kind of standing there awkwardly going, what else can we shout?
And McCrory is thinking, I can't catch a break. And look at former South Carolina governor, where she is, Nikki Haley. Yeah. And here I am in an alley getting yelled at. This is not good.
But he seemed, to his credit, he seemed calm and smiling through most of it, although you know it had to be really uncomfortable.
Sure.
For
him
rough,
and the
it
other
was rude.
People. Yeah.
Yeah.
This incident did not go unnoticed by Mecklenburg County Republican State Senator Dan Bishop, who also saw the video.
There was a particular moment about a minute in, as I commented in my press release, that one of the people accosting him said, we've got you now, that because he was pinned against a door in the company, some people trying to get in. That's borderline. And it just struck me. I mean, the governor of North Carolina has security. And here's a governor who's taken a tremendous amount of personal abuse. And the line, you never know when the line is going to be crossed, and he may be in personal danger, and he has no protection.
That came from a conversation you, Tom, had with Dan Bishop earlier this week. That realization led to plans to introduce a bill to protect former elected officials from angry protesters. What would this bill do?
We don't know yet because details have not been released. The bill is still being written, but Senator Bishop does say that he will introduce it this legislative session. What we do know is the motivation that he had for the idea of this law, and he actually went into depth with it with me on it. The first is actually a current law that's on the books here in North Carolina, which protects elected but not installed political figures and current political figures. And when I say political figures, it's also members of, judges, members of the judiciary. The other one is a D.C. statute that also offers protections for, family members.
In what way? What kinds of protections?
Well, that's the key thing here, because really what this is this boils down to a fight between protection and First Amendment rights to protest and freedom of speech. And I do think, before I go into details, it's important to note no charges were brought in D.C. for this moment. It was actually just considered a normal protest. So the D.C. statute, I'm not an expert on D.C. statute, so I called the ACLU of District of Columbia and asked them if they knew of this statute and to watch the video that we've been talking about. And their legal director watched it, and he said, you know what? This statute would not have been used in this case.
Well, the reason I asked about what kind of protections, the president-elect and the vice president-elect get Secret Service protection. Mm-hmm. The president and vice president get Secret Service protection.
The governor
and
gets former, state troopers.
And former presidents and vice presidents continue to have mm-hmm. Secret Service protection. Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't the same be a good thing for former governors and members of the House, et cetera,
it's speakers of darn House. Expensive. And let's face it, most former governors don't need a personal bodyguard like a former president or vice president of the United States.
And that incident notwithstanding, I don't believe former Governor McCrory needs bodyguards either. I would have a hard time believing that a law banning that, what we saw, would hold up. Mm-hmm. It made me a little uncomfortable watching it, but I think they were well within their First Amendment rights.
And that's the thing. I mean, let's face it, democracy, especially a democracy where you have freedom of speech, it can be vulgar. It can be downright nasty, but that is the right of the people. I mean, I brought up the ACLU before. This is the same group who's also defended, white supremacists' right to have rallies and to speak. We don't have to like what people are saying, but they have a right to say.
Yeah, you think about these guys in Kansas who go up and hold up the really offensive banners and shout things at veterans' funerals.
Right.
Everybody hates that, but it's allowed. If somebody were to chase Mike Collins down the street because they didn't like Charlotte Squawks, I'm assuming there's a line they couldn't cross.
They'd be very intelligent.
They would never do that. But
they'd be very intelligent. Go ahead.
There's already a laws against assault, as Tom said. This wouldn't cross the line. This would be like felony yelling. And people have that right to do it. And it's kind of ironic to me because there's always been this push now, we're being too politically correct and people should say more what they feel.
Yeah.
And so the irony is some of the same people who made those charges are saying, oh my goodness, I can't take this. Somebody's being rude to me. It, as Glenn said, makes you uncomfortable. But if this, is not an irony, I don't know.
And Dan Bishop even said to me when I interviewed him, because I asked him about it, he understands the First Amendment. He admitted it in this case, this was not likely assault. And assault, to those people who don't know, that's not a physical act. That's an intimidation act. And both the North Carolina law and the D.C. statute are there to basically stop the kind of strong-arm thuggery corruption that can influence legislation. There's a reason it's for recently elected and current public officials and not private citizens. Politicians, you're never forced to become a politician. People do need to understand that with that choice that you make to run for office, and if you're elected, yeah, you could see people not happy with what you did, and they have a right to protest.
That comes with the territory. Okay, the legislature opened their new session this week, and I was struck by an article in the Raleigh News and Observer that said Senate and House Democrats outlined their agenda for the session, expressing optimism that they can find sufficient bipartisan agreement on their goals. Really? Is that even remotely possible?
I mean, let's face it. The Republicans have supermajorities still in North Carolina House and Senate. But Democrat votes do matter. Look at House Bill 2. If there is going to be a repeal, and at this press conference, they called for the full, unequivocal, unconditional repeal of House Bill 2. It would take Democratic votes to pass that. But, you know, it's a tough slog in Raleigh for Democrats. They don't hold – I mean, what's interesting is for the first time in I don't know how long, we actually are going to watch divided government here in North Carolina. They have a Democratic governor. His vetoes can be overruled by the General Assembly, but it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Well, on that agenda, aside from repealing HB2, is the expansion of Medicaid coverage something that the governor wants to do, shifting tax breaks to the middle class and small businesses, raising teacher pay, among other things. Is there any support on the Republican side of the aisle for any of those things?
I think for raising teacher pay. The argument always comes in on how to do it, but I think that that is one of the points where that is frequently cited as something where they're going to come together. And the Democrats are probably going to have to be smart and say, you know, we'll try to influence this if we have a different strategy for how it ought to be done. But in the end, we're all going to take credit for this.
And in fact, Governor Cooper has asked business leaders to push for teacher pay hikes over tax cuts. That sounds like an unusual move. Is it, and are they likely to respond to that request?
Well, Senator Phil Berger has plainly basically said no, that tax cuts are part and parcel with their priorities because it's growing North Carolina's economy and income. And in fairness, you know, our economy is doing really well. The coffers of state government are doing really well. Now, you can argue whether or not that's due to growth, whether that's due to tax cuts, whether it's a combination. You could do a whole show on that. But the one play that I'm watching, and this has many levels, is actually about Medicaid expansion, because one of the things that Medicaid expansion could do, which could garner it some Republican support in the General Assembly, is it could really help bolster the bottom line of rural hospitals and who, you know, can find themselves stuck with unpayable, you know, patients with unpayable bills, but they still have to treat them because they've shown up at an emergency room. I'm curious to see how that goes, but there are so many levels from Washington on down for that to actually happen that I'm not sure it's even in our hands to decide anymore.
Glenn.
What I give the Democrats credit for is putting forth an agenda. In the last few years, it seems to me that they've really been back on their heels and they've been irrelevant. If they're going to stand a chance, even in these gerrymandered districts or especially with the gerrymandered districts of getting power again, they've got to put forward a different agenda. They've got to put forward a different vision, and perhaps this is the first step toward doing that.
And if Democrats hope to have regained power at the national level, don't they have to begin in the states?
Absolutely, and maybe even below the state level.
Yeah, and local level.
Right, local level.
The legislature is also planning to revisit a bill that they passed that reduced class size, but it's led some school systems around the state to say, okay, in order to make this work, we have to cancel physical education and cut arts education. And legislators say that was an unintended consequence. What are they talking about here?
Well, they're talking about and again, it's one of these things where everybody agrees in theory it would be really nice to have smaller classes, more teachers, fewer kids. It's that more teachers part of the variable that they didn't really take into the account. They just sort of said, okay, we're going to set these ratios, but we're not providing you money for more teachers. So the question becomes, if you have to move that class size from 20 to 14 or whatever it is, where do those more teachers come from?
How could they not have done that calculation? If you're going to have smaller classes in the same student population, you have to have more classrooms and more teachers.
Well,
right?
Unfunded mandates are not exactly a huge innovation. This happens a lot. So either you go to the county commissioners and say, we need more K-3 teachers, and the county commissioners say, sure, while we're writing checks for the soccer stadium, here's a check for teachers. Or you say, we've got the same amount of money, roughly, and so you start looking within that building. You know, you either make larger class sizes in the higher grades, or you start pulling in your your art and your PE teachers. And Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools has said it's too early to say we're going to kind of hope that, you know, that this all gets worked out. And there is some sentiment out there that they will try to provide some flexibility. But I think Wake and some other districts probably did a smart move and came out and said, this is how it might play out. You may not like it.
Do we have separate PE teachers? In other words, in Mecklenburg County, are the people that teach PE, is that all that they teach? Because when I went to school, our PE teacher was our history teacher or our political science teacher. They just put on a pair of shorts and went down there for a period and did it.
I believe in elementary schools, they are PE teachers. In okay. higher grades, they're often PE/coaches. But you're right. You know, we had like a health teacher who was yeah. also a PE teacher.
Okay. Speaking of education, Charlotte Mecklenburg School Board went into special session this week to talk about equity. This is a word that we keep bandying about. And what does equity mean? And not the actors union. What does equity mean?
Well, what they would say is that it's the idea that you have to give every student what they need to have a good shot at a great education, and that equity as opposed to equality. Equality is you make sure that every school has exactly the same level of teachers and books and technology. And equity is saying in a school where most of the kids come in with a lot of disadvantages, they need more.
But we've been talking, well, the school board has been talking about this for quite some time
yes.
now. And they're still trying to define it. And Tom Tate, school board member, pointed out they've been discussing this for 20 years. So why can't they define it? Why don't they know what it is? Why don't they know how to measure it?
Well, measuring it is complicated, and they have had various – there used to be an equity report, and I covered a bunch of them where they deliver this big data dump. And, again, things like buildings and technology that are quantifiable are fairly easy to measure. Things like good teaching are really, really hard to measure. They used to do it looking at credentials and at experience, and I think the consensus was that didn't really tell you. Although you are now hearing some board members say experience does make a difference. Not that an experienced teacher is always a great teacher, but if you have a large school where virtually all of your teachers are churning through every 3 to 5 years, that's not an optimum situation. Mm-hmm. So they are trying to figure out how to put this into policy and how it influences. And part of what they've said is we are always talking about equity. We are always acting on equity in these other areas. We just, you know, it's sort of a you-know-it-when-you-see-it thing. We don't know exactly
and
how to define it.
Well, if they're always acting on equity and always talking about it, the discussion, this discussion, particular discussion, was driven in part by an accreditation visit by Advanced Ed, is what they're called, I guess, which criticized the district for failing to consistently define the issue.
Right. So this is not just, you know, somebody in the media or Ann Clark or somebody saying it's a problem that
are they under a mandate from this organization or a timetable of some sort, or is that just a critique that they either paid for or didn't pay for?
They will come back at some point, and there are things that they say they wanted to see CMS improve, including their facilities. They really dinged them on how far behind they were on school construction.
So are they a consultant that's hired by the school system, or are they just an organization that comes into all school systems and says, here's what you need to do?
They are hired, and my understanding is that accreditation does matter quite a bit, although I have to admit I'm not as up to speed on that as I should be.
When we come back, we'll talk about boundary changes. We'll talk about the CIAA, and the award this week goes to Glenn because he gets to bring up HB2 again. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Queen's Feast, Charlotte Restaurant Week, now through Sunday with more than 130 metro area restaurants offering three-course prefix dinners, menus, and reservations at charlotterestaurantweek.com. Week one of the Trump administration saw a stack of executive orders, protests in Washington, in Charlotte, across the country, and debate over alternative facts. On Point's weekly news roundtable goes behind this week's headlines, including rumblings of a Supreme Court nomination and the death of Mary Tyler Moore. That's coming up in 20 minutes as the news roundup continues on a national level here on WFAE. We're coming right back. Stay with us.
Politicians of all stripes like to say they can do extraordinary things to rev up the economy, but then reality
the president is not going to find a button on his desk that he can push to raise productivity. It's just not that simple.
I'm Kai Rizdal, embracing the ordinary economy, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30, following All Things Considered, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup today with Ann Dawes Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com, Mary C. Curtis with NBC BLK. I love saying NBC BLK. Is that what I said?
Yes.
Roll Call and WCCB. And Tom Bullock from WFAE News. We're talking just before the break about the school board and the school situation. The board is moving ahead now with possible boundary changes, and they're wrestling with questions like, is it more important to relieve crowded schools to keep students close to home or to break up concentrations of poverty? I thought that was the whole purpose of changing the boundaries, to break up concentrations of poverty.
And you would be on the same page with several school board members who are kind of saying, look, we made this our focus, and we've talked about this, this is a desperate need. Are we going to be serious about this? You know, 5 years from now, are we going to be saying essentially, remember back when resegregation hit its peak back there before they made these changes? But I think there's another group that says, you know, that's aspirational. We're always going to be thinking about poverty and disadvantage, but really our first commitment here is to protecting successful schools and keeping kids close to home. And
what about improving poor performing schools? Where does that fall on the list?
Well, A, I think that especially the people who don't want to see dramatic change would say assignment does not improve poor performance. It may move around the low-performing kids.
But wait a minute. Isn't there empirical evidence that shows when you put poor-performing kids in with higher-performing kids, their performance is raised?
That is definitely something that sets a much better stage for – nobody thinks it's great for kids to be in a setting where virtually all – kids have some high level of disadvantage. And one really big challenge is it would be one thing if we had 20 high poverty schools out of 168. We have 77 that are at least three quarters poor. And that was, again, one of the things that was kicked around was how do we, you know, what is the desirable level? How do we even approach this? Do we say no school should be above X percent? Do we say we want that number of 77 to go down to 50 or 30 or 20?
So now this process began a while ago, and then they seem to have put the brakes on it, and now they're back but not quite moving as quickly as they were before. Is that an accurate assessment?
I think it's really tough to assess where they are now. There was not a flat-out, let's pull the plug, let's stop this.
Start talking about redrawing boundaries. That affects so many people and so many things and issues like real estate and where I want to live. So when are they going to come to a decision? Because this is kind of churning the butter churn for no apparent reason if you're not going to reach a conclusion at some point in the near future.
And that is one of the big fears, I think, is that if you have people that say, well, we can only do so much in these 4 or 5 months, but we need to – somebody referred to it. The Magnet Plan was described as a 4-year rolling plan in which they keep adding programs. And somebody said, do we do boundaries as a 4-year rolling project? And I think there was sort of a, no, please, let's not do that.
Could they be waiting for Wilcox to come in and put the blame on him when it doesn't work right?
That's a good question as to whether, I don't know, put the blame on him. That would seem to be politically then more savvy to put the blame on Ann Clark and let her walk out the door. I wonder if there's some sense that Wilcox might lead this in a different direction.
Mary Curtis.
Yeah, because of the vestiges of housing segregation and how Charlotte was built, you're always going to have all of these different priorities and contradictions bumping up against each other. If it's going to be homeschools and you want to be close to your home, that's going to be a problem. But at the same time, these parents who are coming to the meetings and saying, we don't want this uncertainty, can always say, well, we might just send our kids to private schools or charter schools or homeschool them, and they can hold them hostage in that way. I really wouldn't say hostage, but they have different priorities. So this is one of these things that just keeps going, as you say, Anne. It's a cycle. And it's a wonder if we'll ever be able to come to the end of that.
Glenn.
Some of the boundaries, when I look at them, they're rather illogical in terms of where the school is in relation to where the boundary is. Were those boundaries or those areas gerrymandered, if you will, to get certain demographics?
That's a great question. And I think, yes, diversity has always been one of their goals. So,
no, I was asking the other way. Were they?
Well, and that's the even better question, because sometimes they do seem to have had the opposite effect. And there is such a thing as political pressure, and people represent their constituents. And that's one of the things that's they're all sort of talking obliquely, because there are no specifics. But they have talked about the low-hanging fruit or the easy changes. And one interpretation of that would be some of these boundaries that are gerrymandered to prevent or to reduce diversity, do you carve them off? And that's when the minute that anybody's neighborhood goes on a map and you're moving from school A to school B is when I think we see the public engagement rise.
Well, meanwhile, Dr. Ron Carter is preparing to step down as president of Johnson C. Smith University. And Glenn, you've been looking at his legacy and at what the future looks like for JCSU and that region of the town when he is gone. What have you come up with?
Well, he spoke last week this week at the Tuesday Morning Breakfast Forum. He was full of optimism and some pessimism. He was very optimistic about the future of JCSU and his legacy there. He believes that some of the things that he has put in place there will remain after him. He also spoke about the CIAA, which is coming. When the CIAA back in September announced that they were going to keep the tournament here and move, I believe, 8 of their lesser championships out of the city, we all thought that that was the end of it, that the tournament would be here through 2020, which is the end of its contractual term. Well, he said not necessarily, and the commissioner reiterated that during a press conference this week.
They're going to play the games here this February, next month.
Next month, starting on the 21st.
But they could decide to move next year's tournament.
They're still looking at HB2. They're still looking at
Why are they playing the games here now when the NBA, the NCAA, the ACC have all pulled out?
They say time. I believe it was more about money. Eight of the 12 CIAA member schools are in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. When you have that many students, that many parents, that many alumni so close to home, it's difficult to move it to another state.
Okay. And Dr. Carter also said something this week. I don't know whether he said it at that meeting that you referred to or not, but he said we have to be very careful that we do not allow an elite minority to rule the country. This has to be a country ruled by the majority. And he said if we're not careful, that America by 2035 will begin to show signs of the old apartheid South Africa.
He spent 10 years in South Africa, much of it during the apartheid era. And he said he sees similarities between what they had there and what is developing here. And his definition of minority rule was not about just about race. It was more about an elite minority. And the concern that we're not educating a large portion of what will be the majority. Charlotte is no longer whatever the term is. This is going to happen nationally.
The minority majority.
Yeah, minority majority. This is going to happen nationally just in a couple decades.
And actually, I thought it was by 2030.
Is it 2030? Okay.
I think.
His concern is that we're not educating the people who will make up the majority at some point.
We already have the social mobility problems in Charlotte that we've seen. So we see that if a kid is born in poverty, that he has a terrible chance of improvement, and part of that is education. So I would say there's something to that when you think that these are our young people, these are our future, and yet already they don't have those same chances. So
let's very quickly go through some things that have been happening to local people in Washington. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, not a Trump supporter, was nonetheless his nominee to be U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. She was approved by the Senate 96-4. And I say former governor because she's already been sworn in as ambassador and she's flown to New York.
Yep.
So why was the vote so decidedly in her favor given her lack of foreign policy experience?
Two reasons. Number one, she's pretty non-controversial for a Trump appointee. And number two, that's pretty much standard policy. The president gets to pick, although the Senate does get to confirm, key people. And
unless your name is Obama? Is that
no, actually, if you people forget that like President Trump, President Obama came in with Democrats
right.
Controlling both. So it's you know, the president, the Senate will give them a whole lot of heat, but they tend to go with whoever the president picks.
She was smart. She was very smart.
I thought she was
great answers, and as opposed to some of the other nominees who had a, shall we say, rocky time.
Yes.
And also, she's one of the few diverse members of the Trump cabinet.
Well, it's been a rocky time for South Carolina's Mick Mulvaney, Trump's choice to head the Office of Management and Budget. Is he running into headwinds simply because of the revelation that he forgot to pay employment taxes for his triplets' nanny for 5 years, or are there other forces?
That's a big thing, especially for a guy who's going to be, you know, basically your top accountant for the U.S. government. But there's more to it than just that. He's known really as a budget hawk and has gone out. He was pro government shutdown. He is would love to see the defense budget cut.
He wants to raise the retirement age to 70, cut Social Security and Medicare.
That's actually not as controversial with some Republican leaders, but the defense budget cuts really are, especially at a time when you have a president who is saying we need to rebuild the economy or the Defense Department and the military. I'm curious to see how it goes. I think he will probably go through, but it's going to be a hard slog.
Senate Republicans are upset with the pace at which Donald Trump's cabinet nominees are being approved. Republican Senator John Cornyn from Texas said, and this is a quote, "Our Democratic friends need to get over the fact that the election is over and now we have the responsibility of governing, hopefully together, but instead, so far, they've just chosen to obstruct and foot drag." Is there any difference between what's going on now with Democrats toward Republicans than the promise to obstruct President Obama by Republicans at the very start of his administration and even their refusal to hold hearings on his Supreme Court nominee, Merrick Garland? Any difference at all?
There's a huge difference. With the Obama administration, it wasn't just foot dragging. It's foot dragging now. Then it was just stalling. A lot of his nominees just did not move, and the Supreme Court nominee wasn't the only one. A lot of things on his agenda just the Republicans just refused to act on. Trump's nominees will be approved, and it's just a matter of time.
Yeah, and I agree with everything that Glenn just said, but I do want to bring up one wrinkle, which is the fact that a lot of Trump's nominees did not get their ethics form in on time.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a number of Senate committees that are run by Republicans that are delaying confirmation votes because they're waiting for paperwork.
So when Democrats like Charles Schumer say we need to do our due diligence and can't because the paperwork hasn't come in, they're not fibbing. They're telling the truth.
And they're also finding that some Republican leaders of these key Senate committees are saying the same thing.
Yeah. And also some of the folks that here, when you nominate people to run departments and they don't have any experience in that particular department, when people ask questions, they're doing their job. So these Democratic senators like Al Franken of Minnesota and others who are really going tough on the questions, they're representing their constituents as well.
So things may be slow in the Senate, but things are rapidly happening at the White House there's not enough ink in those pens to continue signing these executive orders that he's signing. But we also experienced since the inauguration, which, by the way, was just last Friday. President Obama was still president at this time last Friday. But what followed the inauguration was what might have been the largest demonstration in the nation's history, because in all 50 states, plus the District of Columbia, which I think had 250,000 people or more marching, women marching, there were marches everywhere, including around the world. So, Anne, Mary, Glenn, some of you were at some of them. What was the atmosphere?
Blown away. Go ahead, Mary.
No. It was incredible because I wasn't even supposed to do some national coverage, and they called and said, no, we want this national coverage, because they really didn't expect it to go on in a state like North Carolina. 3,000 were expected. Over 10,000 were here.
In Charlotte.
In Charlotte. More than 10,000.
Did Raleigh have a similar size?
Oh, they had over 17,000, I heard.
Okay.
People hanging off the parking garages. And there was such a feeling of camaraderie among the women and men and children. It was very peaceful, the march.
You wrote a piece for Roll Call in which you said you thought that you went to the Tea Party convention, the original Tea Party convention several years ago, 2010, I think. And it was considered a novelty at the time. And it's become that's the reason we are where we are today, the success of the Tea Party. You think that the women's movement could have equal success? Is that what I understood?
Well, I was just saying that for folks who said, you know, we already had an election, shut up and just, you know, go along with it. These same folks were actually obstructing President Obama and saying, no, now we need to be the loyal opposition. So I'm just saying, depending upon what the follow-up is, will all of the people who were there, will they keep it up? Will folks run for office? Will they continue to keep in touch with their representatives and their senators and their congresspeople? So a lot of it is the follow-up. And the
I am seeing a lot of that on social media. A lot of people posting and saying, if you were out marching on Saturday, here's how you call Richard Burr to weigh in on this, or here's how you follow up on that. And small, you know, it's that huge turnout is going to be hard to replicate.
And it wasn't just women marching. Glenn, you were there and you said it blew you away.
Right. 2 hours after the march began, people were still going down Church Street trying to get to the park, a full 2 hours. Men, women, I talked to 8 people in particular, men, women, young, old, and they were there for any number of reasons. They weren't all there protesting Trump. They weren't all there advocating for women's rights issues. They were there for a number of left-leaning causes.
Immigration reform, criminal justice reform, reproductive rights, so many things. And it was interesting. They had a bunch of black men from the Omega Sci-Fi fraternity handing out water.
Of the city and state lost Republican lawmaker Ruth Samuelson this week. She died of cancer at a very young age, 57. She was a Republican, raised in a Democratic family, made her mark as a county commissioner, as an environmentalist, was one of the first people to own a Toyota Prius in this area, and she continued that environmental work in the legislature. She's a nonconformist. Any thoughts about her before we have to go?
I think one of the things that people felt was, in a time that's so polarized, here we have someone who was the exact opposite, who was courteous and respectful to everyone. She could stand up very strongly for her views, but she did not at all come across as someone who condemned everybody else.
And Tom Bullock, you need to make a correction before we go.
I do, and I want to thank my colleague David Borax for noting this. It turns out that I said earlier the St. Louis voted down their Major League Soccer plan. They actually just brought it back up, so their bid is still alive. We'll have to stay tuned to see if that happens here in Charlotte.
And a reminder that Connect with Culture Day is tomorrow. All these things are free. All the museums are open free tomorrow. Just thought you ought to know that before we say sayonara.